they ignored it. So much as it is obvious to the entire world, you know, that the international law in this case has now expired, and therefore Iran is free to pursue its nuclear, you know, dreams. But of course, it's still part of the, you know, of the JCPOA. Iran has been, I mean, the most interesting thing, I think, in this whole issue is people keep forgetting that Iran is the one that has its own internal fatwa, a rule whereby it does not believe in having nuclear weapons. Now, this is, of course, also a matter of discussion because a lot of people are urging Iran to now look into that part because it seems to be the only thing that deters any kind of an attack on a nation, such as, you know, we've seen North Korea or we've seen Pakistan and India. When there was a little bit of skirmishness between the two, there was an involvement to ensure that this doesn't go further. Not having nuclear powers leaves Iran quite open to another attack. So if there is any restriction for Iran, it really is internal. It is within the nation itself. But of course, like we know, you know, international law is skewed, and it is only in the interest of the Western nation. So, but I think Iran is right in making this quite clear, because end of the day, you know, we know that the world has now changed. Given these past 2 years of the genocide that we watched and how the West has been exposed to its lies, it is important to keep this subject alive and to make people worldwide understand that actually now it is the Western countries with this snapback mechanism they hold on to that they are the ones who are talking against international law.
And Sakino, your aunt said from before when they triggered this, why are you triggering this? It's about to expire. When it comes to non-compliance, we're not the ones that are fault. It's you three countries, European countries, namely France, the UK, and Germany, that have been non-compliant since basically May of 2018, if not even before that. And they know this. And they know this, and the Iran even told them before they triggered it that you can engage us in respectful dialogue. We will reach a diplomatic solution. So why did they still choose this path, Sister Sakina?
Because they have no interest in having any kind of a deal, you know, having negotiations that will lead to anything concrete. Look, this is all related to Iran's real opposition to the genocide state of Israel. That's what it's all about. These decisions are not taken in Paris or in London. These decisions are taken in Tel Aviv. The reality is that whatever we have witnessed Israel do, you know, the Zionist entity's expansion plan around the world, the real only opposition and resistance that is there is by Iran, you know, with countries like Yemen. But Iran is the main player. And as long as Iran refuses to give in, you know, like, for example, we had this theater in the Sharm el-Sheikh, whereby all the world leaders go together and sign a treaty that we know, everyone knows, is not going to hold or is not a real solution to the end of occupation in Palestine. Iran was invited and Iran refused. And this is because, you know, they are quite clear that this is all propaganda. Now, when Iran continues to defy the West and does not want to do their bidding, every nation is supposed to be subordinate to the United States. And Iran is a country that has its own values and refuses to be a subordinate. And therefore, as long as they continue to refuse this, there will be all sorts of things thrown at it. I see this snapback in the same view. And I think this was the reason. They are trying to find every manner to ensure that, you know, financially, politically, they squeeze Iran to the maximum. But again, like I said, you know, 120 countries met in Kampala and agreed that international law has to be upheld and that Iran is now, you know, these sanctions have expired. And I think, therefore, we will continue to see threats from all sorts of Western countries, including Tel Aviv, towards Iran, because they are not interested in peace. They are not interested in any negotiations. They just want Iran to comply to whatever it is that the United States wants them to do.
All right, stay safe, Sakina. Always a pleasure to have you on. Sakina Dautu, they're joining us from London. Nearly 30 Palestinians have been killed in the Gaza Strip since the ceasefare between Hamas and the Israeli regime went into effect. One of the deadliest strikes, 11 members of a single family, including several children, that is, were killed in Gaza City's Al-Zaytun neighborhood. Meanwhile, the Hamas condemned the attack, saying it showed Israel's premeditated intent to target defenseless civilians once again. It called massacre another violation of the recently agreed ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, Gaza's health officials said nearly 170,000 patients urgently need surgical procedures, but hospitals lack equipment and facilities to treat them. The overall death toll from U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza since October of 2023 has surged to nearly 68,000. Earlier, our Gaza correspondent, Gada Abraham, provided us with more on latest Israeli violations of the ceasefire in the war-torn territory.
The violations of the Israeli regime continued on the expense of the Palestinians here at the Gaza Strip. We are talking about at least 29 Palestinians killed since the beginning of the ceasefire more than a week ago. And this actually is non-stop, as more people are now trying to reach to their areas, to reach to their to the areas the Israeli occupation withdrew from, however, only to be met with the Israeli gunfire, direct shooting, the drone attack, and also the tank shelling that is continuous until this moment. We are from now, from a time and another, we are still hearing the shooting from the Israeli tanks towards the eastern bars of the city of Deir el-Balah, of Khan Yunis, and all the areas like Ash-Shuja'iyah neighborhood, Az-Zaytun neighborhood, and these areas that are in the east of Salah al-Din Street. The Israeli occupation army keeps violating the ceasefire agreement, keeps killing and using the lethal force and the lethal violence against the Palestinians who are trying to go back to their areas. The Israeli occupation army is protecting that these people are crossing the yellow line, the invisible, actually, yellow line, and asking the people here while walking in the street, do you know what is the yellow line? People do not know there exists or actually a yellow line.
And now, moving to the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians continue to suffer from Israeli violence. Regime forces have carried out yet another large-scale raid in the occupied Palestinian territories. Attacks include incursions into Ramallah, Nablus, Al-Quds, and Jenin, among others. The Israeli forces abducted several Palestinians while firing tear gas and throwing stun grenades at them. For more on this, we were earlier joined by Ramallah correspondent, Naka Hamed.
It is a loop of violence on the occupied territory to the north of Ramallah, the village of Kulbar. Since the hours of the morning, the Israeli forces interfered and started shooting live ammunition and started shooting tear gas bombs and detained many of those Palestinians who were just trying to reach out towards their land and towards their olive groves. The same situation happened today in the village of Deir Ammar to the northwest of Ramallah, where the Israeli forces have also attacked the Palestinians, attacked the volunteers. Among them were international activists and helped them.
Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of Yemenis once again take to the streets in nationwide rallies to express solidarity with Palestine and pay tribute to resistance leaders killed by Israel. Yusuf Mowry reports.
The masses took to the streets in another Friday demonstration to commemorate the leaders who have been martyred in the 2 years of Israeli aggression against Muslim nations. In Sana'a, protesters commemorated Major General Mohammed Al-Ghamadi, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike last month.
We came out to say that we are sacrificing our leaders for martyrdom in the path of Allah. The blood of these martyrs paves the way for victory for the Islamic world. It has already granted victory and honor to the Palestinians and lifted the siege against Gaza.
Protesters also praised the Palestinian people for achieving a historic victory against the Israeli regime. In 2 years of Palestinian resistance, many leaders fell, including Yahya Sinwar, who was martyred while fighting until his very last breath.
We are here to congratulate the Palestinians on their victory and to praise their patience and steadfastness. You have proven to the world that you will never forsake your land and your cause. We will remain with you all the way.
For Yemenis, many more battles are still ahead, and Yemen will be prepared for another round against Israel.
Our motto is, if they resume their attacks, we will return with our punishments. We tell our brothers in Gaza and our brothers across the world that we will continue with our fight against tyranny and oppression, and we will remain on this path to sacrifice our blood for the sake of Allah.
As Israel continues its war crimes across West Asia, Yemenis say Israel will pay a heavy price sooner or later. But how does Yemen plan on making Israel pay? Yemeni military officials have hinted at the revelation of new precision missiles that Israeli anti-missile systems will have no answer for. Yemenis here believe that the country's armed forces should continue to develop and manufacture precision missiles, which they believe should be used to deter the Israeli regime from continuing its acts of aggression against the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
Human rights advocates are raising an alarm over violent treatment of 22-year-old political prisoner Mohammed Umar Khalid, currently being held on remand at a prison in London. Umar is accused of participating in a protest that targeted Israel's arms manufacturer Elbit Systems. Our reporter Latifa Al-Rishak reports.
Inside Wormwood Scrubs, Muhammad Omar Khalid is facing what supporters describe as religious persecution and state retaliation for his political beliefs. The 22-year-old was arrested on the 1st of August and has since been held without trial, after being accused of taking part in direct action against Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons producer. His protest targeted the UK's ongoing military ties to Israel, which, in addition to supplying weapons, has also collected surveillance intelligence over Gaza at the expense of the UK taxpayer. While in custody, Ahmed reports that he has been harassed by prison officers for performing the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer. On October 7th, after refusing to stop his recitation, officers allegedly placed him in a chokehold, stripped him by force, and left him bruised and injured, all without medical care.
Despite being beaten and forcibly strip searched, Omar says in his statement that he knows that he could do more for Palestine and that he has never tasted freedom until now.
British media and politicians have been accused of interfering in the administration of justice by publicly commenting on the Filton 24 case, which has impacted their treatment while in remand. The assault, coupled with his placement in solitary confinement, has sparked outrage amongst human rights observers and faith communities.
It's our duty to come here to support him, because the way that they treated him, the way that they oppressed him, and the way that they persecuted him, is not tolerated in any way, shape or form. And what we need to do is to stand firm with him, because just as they try to lower his honor, he'll be also elevated, just like the prisoners in Palestine.
It appears that Britain's so-called counter-terror framework has crossed the line into criminalizing conscience, faith and the right to resist war. Latifa Abu Shahra, London.
17 people have been killed in a Pakistani airstrike in Afghanistan's Paktika province in what Wakaba describes as a violation of a recently extended ceasefire. The strike targeted a busy market in Argun just days after both sides agreed to halt hostilities and prepare for peace talks in Doha. Pakistani officials confirmed cross-border attack but claimed it was a precision strike against Hafiz Gul Bahadur Group, a local faction of Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan. Islamabad says the group is behind a deadly suicide bombing against Pakistani troops in the North Waziristan earlier this week. A security source has said at least 100 Afghan militants have been killed in the past 48 hours, and it comes as high-level negotiations between the two are set to begin Saturday in Qatar. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salam, dear friend. Inshallah, you are doing well, and thank you for choosing this program to listen to. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Come with us because we're going to speak about the concept of award. Nomophobia means the fear of being without your phone. So be with us. At first, we look at the calendar. Today is Saturday, 25th of Rabiul Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 26th of May, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 18th of October, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's learn more about verse 2nd of chapter I read from the Holy Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Allahu alladhi rafa'a as-samawati bighayri 'amadin tarawnaha thumma istawa 'alal 'arsh wasakhkhara ash-shamsa wal qamara kullun yajri li ajalin يدبر الأمر يفصل الآيات لعلكم بلقاء ربكم توقنون.
It is Allah who erected the heavens without pillars that you can see. Then he established himself above the throne and made subject the sun and the moon, each running its course for a specified term. He arranges each matter. He details the signs that you may, of the meeting with your Lord, be certain.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
This verse unveils a scientific fact which was not manifest for anyone at the time of the revelation of the Quran. At that time, the Ptolemaic system governed over the scientific centers and the thoughts of people. According to it, the planets and heavens were considered as the layers of an onion, which were located over each other, and the earth was in the center. About 1,000 years after the revelation of these verses, the knowledge of mankind realized that the mentioned theory was utterly wrong, and the reality is that the celestial planets each rotates on the fixed axis in its own position, suspending and also invariable without having anything to lean against.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness,
as I told you, today we're going to speak about the fear of being without your phone. All of this means no more phobia. Have you ever found yourself getting anxious or even panicked when you couldn't find your phone? Does the thought of being stranded in an isolated place with no cellular service find you with a sense of dread? If so, you just might have some of the symptoms of nomophobia. Mobile phones have become a ubiquitous part of modern life. Not only do they serve as a way to communicate, but they also act as a social network tool, personal organizer, online shopping tool, calendar, alarm clock, and mobile bank. While they are without a doubt beneficial devices, some suggest that over-reliance on digital devices may be a form of behavioral addiction.
Have you ever felt your heart sink when your phone battery flashes red, or panicked when you can't find your phone in your pocket? For most of us, it's a small inconvenience, but for people with nomophobia, it has a true fear, the intense anxiety of being without a mobile phone or losing connection. Nomophobia, short for no mobile phone phobia, describes the overwhelming fear of being separated from your phone, running out of battery, losing signal, or even being unable to check notifications. While many of us feel uneasy without our devices, for people with nomophobia, the fear is so strong it interferes with daily life, causes, and psychological background. So why does this happen? Psychologists believe it's linked to our growing dependence on technology. Phones have become more than tools. There are calendars, social networks, entertainment, and even our sense of safety. For some, the idea of losing access to these functions sparks intense anxiety, almost like losing a lifeline. Studies even show that young adults who grew up surrounded by smartphones are especially vulnerable to this phobia. Real-life impact, the impact can be surprisingly severe. People with nomophobia might check their phones hundreds of times a day, sleep with their devices under their pillows, or feel panic when separated from them, even for a short time. Social situations, travel, or areas with poor reception become sources of stress. And ironically, the very devices meant to connect us can leave people feeling more trapped than free. The good news is that nomophobia can be managed. Therapists often recommend setting boundaries with technology, like digital detoxes, scheduled phone breaks, or gradually increasing time away from the device. Cognitive behavioral therapy can help reshape the anxious thoughts, while mindfulness practices teach people to stay calm and present without relying on constant digital input. Nomophobia shows just how deeply technology has woven itself into our lives. While phones connect us to the world, for some, they also create chains of dependency. The challenge is finding balance using technology as a tool, without letting it control us. So the next time your phone dies, take a breath. Maybe it's not just lost connection. Maybe it's a chance to reconnect with yourself.
IRIB English Radio presents today's special, Every Day for 15 Minutes. Today's special. Ways to reduce phone separation anxiety. Try a few minutes of deep breathing or meditation in the morning instead of checking social media. We often go to browse your phones by default, but by choosing a different non-phone activity like a deep breathing or a simple focus meditation, you can decrease your attachment to your phone. It's also just a nicer way to start the day in a stress-free way. Let your battery drain to zero without reasonable, safe circumstances. One tried and true method for many anxiety disorders, particularly phobias, is exposure therapy. After afraid of a dead phone battery,
Try sitting with a drained phone battery while you're at home, sitting without access to your phone while it charges for increasing periods of time will show you that you will still survive without it. This is today's special, and why we can't be without our phone. The National Institute on Drug Abuse for Teens suggests that this cell phone separation anxiety may be more common in teens and young adults. Young people in this age cohort are mostly digital natives, meaning they were born and brought up in the age of digital technology because they had early experience with computers, the internet, the cell phones. These devices are often an integral part of daily life.
So have you ever heard of the term intermittent fasting? In the health and wellness world, then I'm sure you probably have. It's a trendy way to lose weight based on compressing the time window of eating. Usually the hours of eating are open from noon to 8 p.m. or even as small as 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. 4-hour window. The concept builds in parameters so that the person who would reach for the donut at 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. they won't. They can't. Today, you and I together are going to make the term intermittent screen time fasting a thing. Yep, it's going to become popular. We're doing it right here. According to Data Reportal, as of 2023, the average American spends 6 hours and 59 minutes on the screen per day. And there is no sign of this number reversing unless you make the conscious choice to do so. You've probably heard a friend say, hey, I'm going to go on a social media fast for a week. My question after someone whom I know has done this is always, did you miss it? And their answer is, nope. So why isn't it as easy for everyone to turn off their phone and put their screens down? Nomophobia. Yes, there's actually a phobia which describes the fear of being without a phone. That's the world we live in now.
So, today we learned more about verse 2nd of chapter read, and also we discuss about nomophobia, that means the fear of being without your phone. I think that's very interesting topic to discuss more about, so we choose it for further discussion on today's special. We leave you in Allah's blessings and fi aman Allah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Ali Imami. La fata illa Ali, Ali Imami, Ali Imami, Ali Imami. La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Ali
life is full of choices. Choose the best option. We visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amal Kazmi, and in this show we delve into the forces of war, imperialism and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. Today it is a singular honour for me to be joined by Huda Amouri. Huda is a pioneering Palestine Iraqi political leader, organiser and campaigner, best known for co-founding the Direct Action Network Palestine Action in 2020. Dedicated to disrupting the Zionist war machine in Britain, mainly by targeting Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. But earlier this year, the British government prescribed Palestine Action as a so-called terrorist organization, something which Huda is challenging in court. Indeed, Huda continues to campaign and to make sacrifices in support of Palestinian liberation, and it's my pleasure to welcome her to the show today. So Huda, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I have to say I've been very pleasantly surprised by certain individuals who I've known for many years. I won't name them, but I've known them for many years, and I don't think they'll mind me saying that, you know, they wouldn't even consider themselves to be some great political radicals. Quite the contrary, but they've been absolutely disgusted by the prescription of Palestine Action, and they are some of the people who have been alleged to have been holding those placards. So, I mean, the breadth of support is absolutely massive. I mean, I just wanted to ask you about, just relatedly, the excuse that these British government ministers keep making about the prescription of Palestine Action, because you may have seen some of them when they've been challenged. They just say, well, there was this intelligence that they had, which meant that, you know, Palestine Action was such a massive threat that it had to be prescribed immediately. I mean, it seems clear to most people that this intelligence excuse is just a load of nonsense. What's your position on that?
Yeah, I mean, it is. We know why we're prescribed, or the basis that they have prescribed Palestine Action is because of property damage for a political cause. It's been in there since the start of the Terrorism Act about, you know, if you cause serious property damage for political cause, it just hasn't been used to prescribe a group like Palestine Action, because the vast majority of people do not see that as terrorism. And so we know that's why we're prescribed. That's the basis of the prescription. It's really clear from the papers. And I think this idea of using this secret intelligence, or we've seen it before. We saw it before with the Iraq war. It's just this wink and trust me, I know what we're saying. And I don't think it's got them very far by using these dirty tricks to try and justify the prescription. I mean, they also had the Iranian funding. Right, and that's just disappeared. That's not in the case. You know, they even said to Private Eye, oh, we don't recognise that claim. But, you know, just days before the vote was going through, it was all over the Times. Are they getting Iranian funding? And all these questions, all this foreign influence. And then it just disappeared once the vote passed. Because it was complete, complete lies that they were trying to use these types of tactics to manufacture consent. And it's racist, right? You're not going to say an environmental group, oh, you got funding from, I don't know, Switzerland or Russia. You're not going to say suggest that. But because it's about Palestine, you then try and make these links in people's heads where you've already been, you know, pumping this kind of racist rhetoric about foreign influence and etc. in people's heads for so long. So, oh, it's Palestine, it must have a foreign influence.
And I think they're just deeply embarrassed by the fact. Look, I am Palestinian, I am Iraqi. I was also born and raised in Britain. I think they're just deeply embarrassed by the fact that this is a domestic issue and that they're prescribing a domestic direct action route for tackling Britain's role with the colonization of Palestine and their ongoing role with Zionism and these weapons factories that are on their doorstep. So they resort to these tactics to try and smear us. And Yvette Cooper was relentless, you know, and they also said that that there's future planning that they had to stop, right? But it's really interesting because we know they had decided to prescribe us in March. So we met the criteria in March 2025. They didn't prescribe us until right after the action at the RAF base. And that was 4 months' time frame. So if your reason for prescribing is to stop some imminent, you know, the way they make it sound is very ominous and scary. That's the intention. Why did you wait 4 months to prescribe as if there was something imminent going to happen? Now, I've seen the documents. It's just fabrication, and they're just trying to use buzzwords to sound like, oh, look, we stopped something huge from happening. What did they stop? What, people shutting down weapons factories? Is that what you're protecting the general public from? It has no effect on the general public. It only has an effect on the weapons industry. That's what Palace Arts has been doing for years. So I think they just have to, if they said the truth about why they were doing this, and what Palace Arts was actually about, then they would have no legitimacy. So they have to resort to smear tactics and to lies, basically, in order to justify it. But I'm also really impressed by how little that has affected people's view. I think people are not easily fooled. They are regularly insulting the intelligence of normal people. I think 2 years of genocide has also made people very critical of what the government has to say around these topics. And you know, we've seen this before. So yeah, I mean, they have tried to say a lot of things and to adapt the story of why we are prescribed based on the amount of support that was growing. And what they would do, Yvette Cooper especially, whenever there was one of these Defend Our Juries Lift the Ban actions going to happen on a Saturday, it would be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, there would be another minister saying another, you know, fabrication or smear about Palestine action, and they would have a planned campaign for the week before to try and knock down those numbers, to try and deter people from standing up against this prescription.
Of course, just for our viewers who may not necessarily be aware, particularly internationally, those Defend Our Jury actions have been sort of people en masse gathering in public, holding placards, alleged to have been holding placards saying, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action, and of course they've been arrested in a sort of act of mass civil disobedience. But I think you're absolutely right that this isn't cutting through with most people, and it's clear that there's been a lot of discontent, even among the British establishment, about the prescription of Palestine action, because obviously we were talking before about the, you know, the huge grassroots support, but also you have even the pro-Israel Telegraph newspaper publishing numerous articles against prescription, and you have commentators ranging from Tories like Andrew Neil to liberals like James O'Brien saying that it shouldn't have been prescribed. And then very recently, the investigative journalist Matt Kennard revealed that a source close to the senior leadership of Britain's foreign intelligence agency, MI6, has said that there's significant opposition within MI6 to the prescription. Have you been surprised by the breadth of opposition towards the prescription of Palestine action?
Yes, I think the true answer is yes, I have been surprised. You know, before prescription, as I mentioned before, Palestine Action's campaign wasn't targeted at getting in the media or in the mainstream media. It was about shutting down these weapons factories. And we also want to say that that doesn't often interest the mainstream media or regular actions like Elbit Systems. And so we had a, we did have a brilliant base of support in the community surrounding these factories and in the Palestine movement, amongst the grassroots of the Palestine movement. We didn't have much mainstream support from the major organizations, and that was just the reality. So when the prescription started coming through, and to see the backlash was incredible. And you can, as a movement, it is a it's a very unique thing to go through, to say that the group you're involved in is going to be described as a terrorist organization. And but at the same time, seeing how many people were coming out against it from across the political spectrum, it was clear that this was a mistake by the state, that they made a huge political mistake in doing this, and it is having a backlash.
Other, we left off talking about the disunity within the British state and how we have different elements of the state fighting against each other when it comes to the British government's designation of Palestine Action as a so-called terrorist organization. So you have Britain's premier foreign intelligence agency, MI6, leaking to the media that they oppose the prescription of Palestine Action. So this is something that we should be surely exploiting. I mean, the fact that the British state is not actually united on this.
No, that's definitely true. I probably should say Yvette Cooper, actually. And I think it's interesting that she's no longer Home Secretary quite soon afterwards. I know she's now Foreign Secretary, but it's still very interesting that she's not sticking this through, and it's been passed on to Shabana Mahmood to deal with it, who, we can go on to that. But yeah, I think with MI6, I couldn't imagine. If you told me a year ago we'd be in this position at MI6, you'd be saying, no, that's too far. But if you think about it logically, it does make a lot of sense that they wouldn't be pleased with this, because in their eyes, there are certain units that are supposed to deal with activism, right? You have the mainstream police forces, the public order units. Now, when you make a group like Palestine Action a terrorist organization, that will take away resources from other counterterrorism resources, from their resources, and so suddenly they are seeing their resources being used on protesters, on people taking direct action, rather than international groups that are prescribed in Britain. And I think as well for them, the undermining of the public confidence in intelligence agencies, in the terrorism regime, it's really all unraveling now, where people are questioning the Terrorism Act, questioning the parts in it that criminalise free speech and holding placards and making speeches, things that actually we've experienced in the Palestine movement for quite a while. But this has now become a mainstream issue, and people are questioning what these agencies are doing. They're questioning the reasons for the Terrorism Act and how it's being used and weaponized against the general public. So that's what's happening in this situation. And there has been dissent against this. I don't think this is a unified position. I also don't think Yvette Cooper was certain on doing this either, because she waited. She was given the decision that this prescription review group, right, they met in March and they said, they caused serious damage, so they can be prescribed as a terrorist organization, basically. She waited for 4 months. And in that time, some of the reasons they used for delaying the prescription was that the ceasefire broke in Gaza, that it was Ramadan Muslims, that there were criminal trials it could interfere with, and they were worried about losing local elections. So they use all of these political reasons to delay prescribing Palestine action. So how can, you know, they don't even believe that this is an imminent threat to delay it for political reasonings. It's a political tool used to push dissent, and they try to find the most opportune timing, which is probably why they did it after the RAF action. But that hugely backfires on them. And there is dissent amongst people within the state. I think it's a huge problem for them. And to be honest, I think the best thing they could do is just overturn the prescription as soon as possible, or at the very least, you know, not fight the judicial review. Because that's probably going to be their way out of this mess. But I do truly believe that however this is resolved, that Palestine action will be de-prescribed at some point, and there will be consequences for this relaunch, this attack on all of us. For locking up people, for holding up signs, for arresting people at gunpoint, for taking direct action, there will be consequences. And I think Shabana Mahmood, you know, pulling her political career on this is a stupid mistake.
Well, I mean, just to turn to that, obviously, we're talking here about the British Home Secretary. So, of course, that was Yvette Cooper while the prescription was happening. And it seemed that when Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, had this mini reshuffle of his government, that this was going to be a way to potentially try to get out of this mess, that by appointing Shabana Mahmood, someone who had previously expressed sort of pro-Palestine sentiment, is from the Muslim community apparently, that maybe this would be an opportunity for the government with a fresh face to take a different tack. But actually, the British government with Shabana Mahmood has been doubling down despite the huge backlash that they have faced. And of course, in the wake of the Manchester synagogue attack earlier in October, in which one Jewish person was killed by an attacker and another was killed by the police, the Home Secretary said that repeated protests about the same issue will be restricted under new laws. And she said that the right to protest must not be used to intimidate or spread fear amongst communities. What does this say about the Zionist regime's influence and the degree of state capture in Britain now?
I think Shabana Mahmood is very interesting to see her rise. You know, we've seen the videos of her in 2014 during an assault on Gaza, when she's going out making these speeches, speaking very passionately about Palestine. And I think looking at her rise to power, it really does show just how much power corrupts people, and actually how much you have to compromise in order to get to that position. So somebody who was at least seemingly pro-Palestine, I do believe she probably believed in what she was saying back then, has to compromise all of her beliefs on Palestine and actually turn on the Palestine movement in order to maintain her position of power in the British government. I mean, I think that is a very microcosm of showing how Zionism has captured the British government, when you have to make such a U-turn to betray the people that you used to protest amongst and implement more measures upon people to restrict their right to protest on Palestine against the genocide. I don't understand why these people want to get into position in the first place. You know, when if you actually genuinely believe that you want to create change, I think by the time it gets to the top, they have stripped themselves of all of their morality, all of their humanity. The only thing that matters to them is keeping in power, and to do that in Britain, you have to align yourselves with Zionist policies and to keep the status quo going. And so I think, yeah, it's very clear what's happening. And, you know, Yvette Cooper, the previous Home Secretary, was the one who made the decision. That was after extensive lobbying since the start of Palestine Action, from the Israeli government, from Elbit Systems, a foreign weapons manufacturer, from pro-Israel lobby groups, from lords who were paid by weapons manufacturers. So there was a significant amount of foreign influence and lobbying from weapons companies that went into this prescription. So they were willing to prescribe and, you know, launch this huge attack on British citizens in order to protect the interests of a foreign genocidal regime and its weapons manufacturers. And I think that shows how far they are willing to go, that they are willing to lock up their own citizens to protect the ideology and protect Zionism and what it's led to today, which is a genocide in Gaza. And Shabana Mahmood has just picked up that legacy. And, you know, I do find it quite interesting that, you know, I think one of the first posts she did when she became Home Secretary was she was in the police control room with Mark Rowley, the head of Met Police, while over 800 people were being arrested for holding up placards. And she was watching it from this control room and taking pictures and doing a photo op and posted that supporting Palestine isn't the same as supporting a prescribed organization, whatever line she was fed to say. And now she has done this, trying to implement new laws to restrict the right to protest even further in Britain. And I did think, if she was smart, that she wouldn't go down with this ban, and that the smartest thing she could do is just to ignore it, see what happens, because then when it's lifted or overturned or whatever happens with it, it won't be on her legacy or the only back keepers. But that's probably what she'll do. But she has tied herself into the situation where she is now part of enforcing Evac Cooper's ban. And, you know, she is in a very Muslim, majority Muslim constituency. And, you know, what do these people think is going to happen when you betray Palestine, when you betray your own citizens, and when they can see what's going on? She's probably going to lose her seat in the next election. I hope she does. It's very disturbing to see, but I think the one thing we have all gained from this is clarity on how complicit, how involved they are, and how much Zionism has captured British institutions and the British government. At least we have gained the clarity and, in many cases, the courage to resist that.
I'm afraid we have to pause our discussion there, but we'll be back before too long. So thanks, and we'll see you on the next one.
You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may tame both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul.